time. Turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 4. We are waiting for the other classes to finish the foundation material. Being in small groups, they maybe took 2 weeks for some of the lessons because of questions, and there's no need to rush. But we finished according to the plan, and I decided to use a few of the weeks looking at Ecclesiastes. We have several gone today. I'm not sure where they are, but we're glad you're here. We need to acknowledge anytime we come to this book that Solomon is looking at life with God out of the picture when he talks about under the sun. And then when he brings God into the picture, his attitude, and very quickly you see some different points of view that he expresses. God gives us the ability to enjoy life and is considered a gift. But in this chapter, and it begins several places that Solomon takes us, he looks at life under the sun. He looks in chapter 4, the first three verses, he takes us to the courtroom. We go to a place where justice is to be meted out. And he said, I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. They basically are in a hopeless situation. And if you've ever had to go to court, sometimes that is a feeling that is common. Depending on your lawyer, depending on your situations, you can feel confident, but you can feel very much hopeless. And so he's seeing those who go to the courtroom, and there's no one there to provide them comfort. Their situation is a lost situation. And he says, power was on the side of the oppressor, and they have no comforter. So twice, there's no comfort there. And the reason is they're in a courtroom, and they have no one who is on their side as it relates to power, the power of persuasion, the power of the justice system. I have watched every law and order and courtroom show that's ever been produced. I have never wanted to be a lawyer, but I enjoy watching and going through that process. I caught the bug, watching Perry Mason. And of course, Perry Mason, he would go through the process, but just at the end, you never quite knew what was happening. And just at the end, someone would confess and the show would end. And the reality is, in most lawyer court situations, people aren't very quick to confess their wrong. And it's a very different dynamic. I watch Law and Order now. The show Law and Order, I think it's in its 24th season, and many times it ends with the good guys winning, but many times they do not win, and that's more realistic to life. It's a place you stay away from, and especially if you're looking for some decision that perhaps otherwise would not be there. Power was on the side of their oppressor. And that pretty much states the concern that they had. And so then he makes a summation based upon that circumstance. And I declare that the dead who had already died are happier than the living who are still alive. Now, you need to ask yourself something about your situation in life. Do you see the day ahead as a glass half full, half empty? Do you approach it with optimism, or do you approach it for the most part with a great deal of negative pessimism? That statement and your reaction to it would give you an idea of where you are and how you look at life. Now, we have made the comment a number of times, life is daily. It's daily. And a number of things can happen in a given day or week. But his viewpoint is, if it's going to be difficult, it's better to have never been born, because that's not the kind of life you would want. He says it would be better if you had already died, to not go through this. But then later he's going to say that it would be okay if you had never been born, because it's difficult and sometimes you're spared those difficulties. Now, I think that's pretty boring. I think that's pretty pessimistic. I think that definitely is taking God out of the picture, but we know that he's doing that. I know two or three circumstances that has turned young people away from the idea of getting married. And if they have someone in their life, younger, who they saw as the perfect couple with the perfect marriage, and then after several years they divorce, they think, oh no, if they can't make it, no one can. If that's not the perfect marriage, where would you find one? And so for the difficulties that might come and the misconceptions that they draw from that circumstance, they aren't ready and they aren't in a hurry to consider getting married. Children, the same way. If you see having children is a difficult time, and hard, and you may just decide, if I get married, I don't want children. And you're making a decision based upon your perception of what it would be like to have children, with difficulties physically, mentally, to have children who grow up and aren't faithful and don't like you. A lot of decisions sometimes are made as you would see the future and make a judgment about it and choose what you would want. Single, no children, no degree, no master's, no doctorate, whatever it is, making some decisions based upon the information you have. Now, there are a lot more people who get married, have children, do great, and their marriage lasts forever, it seems. But those that don't sometimes gain the attention of those who are young. You agree? Do you know people that make future decisions based upon their conception of something, and it's somewhat a narrow perception compared to the large percentage of people? I'm just suggesting I know those things take place. But then he makes the statement, we're in Ecclesiastes 4, verse 3, better than both if he who has not yet been, who has not seen the evil that is under the sun. So he sees it as just better to have not been there. It's better to not be in that circumstance. Life is difficult. Life is difficult. And then he goes to the marketplace and he looks at earthly endeavors as he sees the people. He says, and I saw that all labor and all achievement spring from man's envy of his neighbor. He's suggesting that the industrious man is motivated by the competition that's around him. And certainly businesses that are striving to maintain a profit, you have to be aware of competition. You have to be aware of the neighbor, if you will. But he sees labor and achievement and springing from a man's envy of his neighbor as meaningless and a chasing after the wind. I think the way I would say it to explain it is seeing the other side of the coin, the purpose that work gives us, the benefits that work gives us, the challenge that it presents. If the reason we're working is out of envy of a neighbor, it's not a good reason. But he sees that, and I won't dispute his words. I'll just try to offer a viewpoint that may help us to understand it. Purpose, benefits, the opportunities that they afford us. He sees it as working out of envy. Then he says, the fool folds his hands and ruins himself. Now he's taking it to the extreme. He's saying there are some who will not choose to work. And if you've ever studied the book of Proverbs, there are several proverbs that speak to the sluggard. He calls him the sluggard. He's the one who folds his hands and finds a reason not to go to work. And some of the verses describe the sluggard as waking up and he sees a lion in the streets, so he's not going to go out into the workplace. There's always something there to keep me from doing that. And he says the fool is the one who folds his hands and it brings ruin. He'll achieve nothing. It's nothing that will be benefited from someone folding their hands and refusing to work, refusing to go into the workplace. Better one handful with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind. Can you say that in different words? Find happiness in less. It's better to have tranquility with less than to think you've got to have so much more and you'll not ever be able to gain it, and therefore you'll not be satisfied. Better with tranquility with one handful than two handfuls with toil, that becomes a chasing after the wind. It's a statement of contentment. It's a statement of reality. I'm an optimistic pragmatist. I lost the word there for a minute. I think I have the ability to see things as they are and then make the best of it. See the good. And this is a person who can see that he'll never have two hands full. He'll never have two handfuls, but he finds tranquility with what he's able to achieve. He's satisfied, another word that says something similar. But two handfuls and not tranquility is chasing after the wind. Now, we've already seen that the person who spends all of his life building a business, he dies, leaves it to a relative, and they don't care about the business. And they sell it overnight. You work all your life to leave something for your family, and when you leave it to them, they don't want it. They don't want the same things that you had. They do want the reward to sell what you worked for. That's not denied, but the appreciation for the business, for your purpose in life, they don't have it. They didn't want to be a part of it, and that's something similar here. Someone, when we were at Parkway, I think I know who, made a statement. I'm not sure if he made it when we studied this, because I don't remember if we studied Ecclesiastes while we were there. But I have written in the margin of my Bible, enough is as good as a feast. Is that true? Enough is as good as a feast. And I think it's true. I think it's a truism. And I think it's encouraging us to appreciate when we have something good. When you've got a good meal, why do you need added to? If you've got sufficient for your life, paying your bills, putting some in savings, enjoying some free time from time to time, enough is as good as a feast. And I've come to appreciate that. And I came to these verses and wrote it down so I would not forget it. Enough is as good as a feast. And it's to our advantage if we can see life that way. If we can respond to that which we have that way. Then he takes us, beginning at verse 7, something else that's meaningless or vanity chasing after the wind. He takes us to an independent man. He's very independent. And we admire that in our culture in America. Someone who's able to move forward as an individual and maintain what he needs, be fruitful as an individual. It's a great quality. But he says, I saw a man all alone. He had neither son nor brother. There was no end to his toil, yet his eyes were not content with his wealth. Now, we've seen several things there, haven't we? We see someone who works hard and has benefited from his hard work. He doesn't see an end to the work. It doesn't suggest that he has to be an alcoholic, a workaholic, I'm sorry. It doesn't suggest that he has to be a workaholic, but he doesn't see that he's going to end that toil. It's as if the retirement point is way down the road and he's not really looking to it. But the difficulty is he's not content with his wealth. And that's a strong statement because he has much. He has much. But he's not content. We have times when we raise our families and we hear others raising their children, when we do something and there doesn't seem to be an appreciation or satisfaction for what you've done. And I developed a word that I would use when talking to parents and even talking in our household. More, more, more. You're always wanting more, more, more. Can't you be satisfied with what you have? With what we're doing? With where we've gone? More, more, more. Never content. Now, he told us why that contentment may be waning or missing. He's working hard, but he has no one to work with or to share it with. He's all alone. No son, no siblings. And so life is difficult. Well, God's out of the picture. Yeah. Yeah, well, that's what we'll say at the end of the chapter, but God's out of the picture, and we have to listen to what he's telling us, and this is a truism when God's not in the picture, but I'm wanting us to see it as he suggested. And then he says, for whom am I toiling And why am I depriving myself of enjoyment? This too is meaningless, a miserable business. Why can't I be happy with what I have? And he uses enjoyment. Why can't I enjoy this? There are movies that have been done in recent years that shows the rich man who goes home to a castle and someone has left him a meal warming in the oven, and it's just work, early in, late out, and you come home to an empty home or house. And this is what's being described. More, more, more. And where's the enjoyment? Why can't I enjoy this? And you'll have to answer that question with God out of the picture. You'll have to answer that question perhaps in discussions that you have with family or friends. Enjoy life. Enjoy the blessings that are given to you. Even with God out of the picture, it's something that can be a blessing to you. But then he moves forward. He's on the highway, and he sees two people walking along the way. Two are better than one, because they have a good return for their work. So remember verse 8, the man was all alone. And he made a lot, but he found no enjoyment in the work. Well, here, there's the acknowledgement that there's a mutual effort and there's mutual support, and they can find a good return for their work. I know the times that I have, in my youth, been assigned a job that was no fun at all, raking the leaves, and you have a big yard. And as soon as you rake them, the next day they're going to be covered, the yard will be covered again. Cleaning out gutters when they're up high. Digging a ditch anywhere for any reason. Having somebody there makes it bearable and doable. It makes it bearable. John? Misery loves company. And you can whistle while you work if you watch some of the television shows that tell us another way to make it pleasing. But here's a man that has someone who's working alongside of him, and they're successful. And then he says, if one falls down, his friend can help him up. And what does that statement remind you of? What commercial comes to mind? I'm falling down and can't get up. And so you need to buy that $60 mechanism that when you fall down, it will know it and trigger a message to someone. It signals someone and they can call help. And I'm not making light of them. They're important. They're very important for someone alone that may be on the floor for a number of hours because no one's there to find them there. Oh, yeah, but there's benefit to them being there and there's gain. But then he says, pity the man who falls and has no one to help him up. I made a comment, I think, in this study a week or two ago. It had to be in this study, but maybe not. Who do you have in this congregation to call when you need assistance? And I heard that statement asked and answered a number of years ago at a congregation, and he put it this way. When you need to move a refrigerator, who can you call to help you? It's important to have people who can help you in such circumstances. He went on and told about the blessing of having someone who owns a pickup truck. And it's also a curse. A blessing because they have the ability to load a refrigerator and help you move it. It's also a curse if you do it 15 times a year. You're the one that has the truck and they call you. But who do you call when you have trouble? You need people that you can call, that you can depend on. And you know they will say yes, and you know they will do it without begrudging the fact that you called them. Falling down and having someone to help you, it's not an impractical thing at all. Pity the person who has a refrigerator they need to move and they don't know who to call and can't have it moved. Put it to modern language. Also, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. Again, the benefit of companionship. It's a metaphor, but it's also reality when it's cold and you're married and you snuggle a little bit. I know people, I'm related to them, not Terry. I know people I'm related to who, no matter what time of year it is, they turn the air conditioner down to 65 degrees at night. And I would not want to pay their air conditioning bill in August, and they live in the South. But they sleep better when it's cool. It lets them snuggle. And we know that word, right? It lets them snuggle. They probably have a blanket or two. But they sleep better when it's cooler at night compared to too warm and they can't relax. It's a benefit to have two when you fall down. They're there to help you up. When you're working, they are there to help you do the work. And there's an element of warmth attached to it. But how can one keep warm alone? And of course, that's a reality of when there's no one there, it's very different than what it would be like if someone were there. Or you miss that circumstance when you had someone there. It's just drawing upon the companionship and the provisions that are attached to it. And though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. People are warned all the time in this country, don't go into certain areas at night, and when you walk, be sure you're with someone. There's an element of assumed safety if there's two people rather than one. And that's what it's reminding us of. And very quickly, without saying it, a cord of three strands is not quickly broken. Now that infers God in the picture, but it's not mentioned. And it's true, without God, if you put three strands together and wrap them, intermingle them, that rope is much, much stronger than one or two strands. So practically, even in the real world, in the physical world, without God, a strand of three is not quickly broken. We see the benefit of two. We see the added benefit of a total of three. Now, what has he told us? What lesson would Solomon have us learn? Don't separate yourself from people. Keep your relationships, whatever your circumstances, keep your relationships. Find people and spend time with them. Work with them. Play with them. Walk with them. Find relationships and they will benefit you. And we would not argue against any of that. We know that it's true. How many of you, I would like for you to raise your hand if you know, how many of you are introverts? I see four or five hands. Our son went to Harding, and there was a group of about eight of them that spent a lot of time together in those first days and weeks. And then at some point they noticed that Eric would not always be there for 3 hours. He kind of disappeared on them, and that's my word. And then in a beginning psychology class one day, they all studied introverts and extroverts. An introvert can be with people, but they gain their energy away from people. They gain their emotional energy, if you will, their social energy, getting away. An extrovert gains their energy, their social energy, by being with people. And they're going to go crazy if they aren't around people. And those five or six of us that raised our hands need to get away from people to recharge. And you may be surprised to know that the majority of ministers are introverts. We love people, but at some point we need to get away. We may not be the last one in the building on a Sunday morning, but we may be the first one because it lets us be with people, but then after a while, we need to get away. And I think this concept is understood. We need people. We don't need hundreds, sometimes a few, but we need people. Even as introverts, we need to be around people. Extrovert, they're the ones that go to a party and they will never leave. They're the life of the party, and they are just filled up with all that they need from being in that environment. And Eric's friends, hearing that lesson, immediately understood where Eric would be after a while. And it bettered their relationship. They understood themselves, and they understood others better. It's good to know if you're an introvert or extrovert. It helps you to understand yourself. It helps you to manage your emotional state, if you will. Observations before we move to something different?
And I might say, one's not right and the other wrong.
No? Yeah, it's not right or wrong. It's just understanding yourself. And it helps you in your relationships. Rick? I wouldn't discount that statement, but I know that an introvert may love to have company, but they need them to leave after 2 or 3 hours. Does that remind you of yourself? You love people, and you have people in, and you're with them. But after a while, it's time for me to go home. Now, I have said this for 43-plus years. I reserve Saturday nights, unless it's really something necessary or special. I need to be home on Saturday, Saturday night especially, because I work hard on Sunday. I know it doesn't look like it sometimes, but emotionally and physically, I'm exhausted on Sunday night. And I feel it on Monday around 2:30. That's when I feel it again the next day. And that's more of the emotional down. And those who study psychology will tell you don't make important decisions on Mondays. That's usually not a good day to make important decisions, for me especially. I'm kind of emotionally down on Mondays. But I can't wait to get to the office, and I don't mind if nobody's there. And that's why the introvert, as a minister, enjoys the quiet time to prepare. I know a minister in the past who was an extrovert. And he would almost brag that he gets up at 4 o'clock on Sunday morning to prepare his sermon. Now that makes no sense to me. It's as if the Spirit's going to zap him with something that early in the morning. He was supposed to be a pretty good speaker, but that's how he operated. I could not sleep on Saturday night if I did not know that I was ready for Sunday morning. So everyone's different. Their personalities are different, and their application of themselves is different. But it is helpful to know that about yourself. Introvert, extrovert, and other things. That's only a beginning. The fourth setting begins in chapter 4, verse 13. Solomon goes to the palace. He goes to the palace. Better a poor but wise youth than an old but foolish king who no longer knows how to take warning. I've written the statement, who no longer can take admonition. The youth may have come from prison to the kingship, or he may have been born in poverty within his kingdom. I saw that all who lived and walked under the sun followed the youth, the king's successor. There was no end to all the people who were before them. But those who came later were not pleased with the successor. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the sun. There's two main messages hidden between these two individuals. One of them doesn't negate the fact that you can't come from a poor or position of less and rise to the top position. That's what the youth did. The king, it doesn't tell us so much about him, except that he had reached the point as he aged that he could no longer take advice. Nothing anybody said he would not listen to. What does that say about him, perhaps? He thought he knew it all. He thought he knew it all. Rick?
Yeah.
Even though it was more than one opinion. In other words, it's a declarative statement, not a may have, maybe he was just scared that way.
Yeah.
Well, the end result is teaching a lesson. Be open for instruction or even criticism. But he also suggests that whoever you are, wherever you come from, there's going to be a point where people may not be satisfied with you. You are the successor to the old king who would not receive instruction or admonition. But at some point, you may face a similar circumstance. You won't be appreciated as you have been in that position and you were there in a better position. You were open to admonition. It encourages us to be open. I was told, they did not know it, that at the time it was important that I heard this statement. I live my life based on it to the best of my ability ever since. Why would I accept criticism from someone that I would never go to for advice? Think about that. Why would I accept criticism from someone that I would never go to for advice? It helps you maybe to be willing to listen, but not necessarily take it in. It's not someone that you value their advice. Another preacher, he had been in a preaching ministry for many, many years, and he was relating to someone who suggested that their wife is their best critic. And by saying that, they value her opinion. And he said very forcefully, immediately, I have enough critics. I need her to be my supporter. I need her to support me. And I understood both of the statements. Open to criticism or instruction is always a good thing. We don't always have to choose to accept it. I learned a lesson from my dad. We have 2 minutes. He was explaining to someone, and I was there, why it's difficult for church leaders to have congregational meetings. In other words, let's have once a year, all the members are invited to a congregational meeting. He said those have value, but there's also harm. At every congregational meeting, you're going to have some people who will say, I told you what you ought to do, and you didn't do it. And they take offense. They argue when something else was done, and they bring it up. I told you what to do. And a congregational meeting is a time to share information. It's not a time to make decisions, but it's a time to share information. And I have found that to probably be true. Because I've recommended something and they didn't do it, I take offense or I bring it up sometime later. I don't know. You look in the mirror and see where you are. Thank you for your interest. We did chapter 5 in 2 sermons a while back. So we will go to chapter 6 next week, Lord willing.